lonely. Elphinstone did We Cry for Harmonia. Horologic by Louise Bach. Unreal City by M. Ward. Normalization Blues by AJJ. Hazy by Hazy Sour Cherry. Taurus did Dressing America. Excellent Choice by TV Dinner Education. The Rolling Stones did In Another Land. We heard Left in the Dark by Galcher Lustwerk. Collective Lung Sampler by Kyle R. Clyde. No Treasure But Hope by Tindersticks. Overtime by U.S. Girls. And in the background now, Me and You Together song by The 1975. And you've been listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? I'm Paul Fisher.
What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with Paul Fisher, was brought to you on recording. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. After a brief cut of music, Dan Persons will give us his evaluation of the Oscar-nominated animated shorts, and then we will hear a reading recorded by N.K. Jemisin. Stay tuned.
remember Grandpa telling me that I was born as the sun was coming up early in the morn. Told me I was born early in the morn. When you lift your eyes and see the sun arising on the far horizon early in the morning,
early in the morning.
It was early in the day when I set out to roam, kissed my love and went to seek my fortune far from home. I set out to roam far away from home. When you lift your eyes and see the sun rising on the far horizon early in the morning,
early in the morning.
But today when I woke, I missed my darling so. Gotta have her by my side forevermore, I know. Need my darling so, evermore, I know. When you lift your eyes and see the sun rising on the far horizon early in the morning,
early in the morning.
So tomorrow I'll be leaving at the break of day. Gonna hurry to my love and there I'll always stay. At the break of day, there I'll always stay. When you lift your eyes and see the sun rising on the far horizon early in the morning.
Early in the morning.
Early in the morning.
I needed to play that. That was the Kingston Trio. Of course, I mostly knew that song as Early in the Morning, but I have a confession to make. When everybody else of my age, and I am, as they say, of a certain age, boomer, everybody else was listening to the Beatles and this and that in the 60s, and I was listening to the Weavers and Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Kingston Trio. And Bob Shane of the Kingston Trio passed away about 2 or 3 days ago, and he was the last surviving member of the original Kingston Trio, and that has brought a lot of nostalgic thinking for me. And it's like, damn, between, I don't know, since December, since the beginning of December, so many people, some of them, you know, personal in my life, some of them celebrities that I knew nothing of, like Kobe Bryant, and just important people to our culture and to my life here and there have been passing away at a seemingly unusual rate. Sidney Smith, Uncle Sidney, has a theory that they all come in threes. And this has been like more than a trio of threes. There have been so many folk, and it's really head-scratching kind of stuff. So let me just, last week I had to play, I had to make mention of the fact that Terry Jones, one of the true geniuses of Monty Python, director of their first two movies, co-directed the first, directed the second alone, he died. And my guest told Teal James Glenn said, well, you know that Neil Ennis died. Neil Ennis wrote all the songs for the Pythons. And you can see him in the movies and in the TV show and stuff like that. And, of course, he was the Bonzo Dog Band. So last week, I had to play music for the Bonzo Dog Band. This week, I've had to play music, and I will also, you know, include that for Python. And this week, it's for the Kingston Trio. And it's like, okay, karma, please stop. You've really taken a toll on all of us. So that's a lot of losses, and mortality sucks, all right? We'll leave it at that. I don't like it. I don't think we should have to endure it, but so mote it be. That's the way it was set up. Okay, now, somehow I'm still playing. Oh, I see. Yes, it's that tab over there. Oh, God. Talk about, you know, songs that depressed me when I was little. Oh, it's songs about hanging. All the folk singers, they love songs about, oh, here I am in the jailhouse, and this is going to happen. And this one probably topped them all.
Poor boy, you're bound to die. I met her.
Not going there. Not going to play that. It bothered me when I was a youngster, and it bothers me now as I'm a middle oldster. Okay. Let's get back to the show, shall we? Dan Persons has a review that I should have played last week, but actually, since this is in theaters this week, it's all the more appropriate. And after that, we're going to have a brilliant, brilliant, great show with N.K. Jemisin, recorded from about 3 years ago. So stay with us. That is to say, stay with us if I don't screw up what I'm playing yet again.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. So the Oscar nominees have been announced, and I'm proud to say that I have now seen almost half of the Best Picture nominees. That's a signal achievement for me, paltry as it is. And I'm going to try to get to Marriage Story at some point before the ceremony, so that'll be something of a record. And I've seen 3 out of the 5 nominated animated features, and of those, my pick would be for Klaus, a very clever and beautifully animated variation on the Santa Claus origin story. I still want to get to I Lost My Body, which is presently on Netflix, and my wild guess for the winner is the one I probably won't get to until later this year, Toy Story 4, because, you know. But I did get to see all of the Oscar-nominated animated shorts, which shorts.tv will be releasing theatrically at the IFC Center in New York on the 29th, and will make available on demand on February 4th. Quick overview. It appears the Academy this year is continuing its ongoing trend of throwing heavy weight toward films that at the very least tug at your heart, if not reduce you to downright tears, favoring them over other kinds of stories. It isn't that there isn't great diversity in the films otherwise. In format, with stop motion and traditional drawn 2D totally elbowing out CG animation this year, and in terms of outlook, with African American, Asian, and European voices all accounted for. The one consistency in all 5 films, though, is that they are all calculated to have you reaching for the tissues by the end. It doesn't always work. That's the case with the French stop-motion animated film Memorable, in which an aging artist experiences a slow decline into dementia by seeing his world transformed into likenesses of classic artists, Dali, Van Gogh, like that. The visuals by directors Bruno Collet and Jean-François Lecor are beautifully done, but aside from the fact that that's not how Alzheimer's works, the story is marred by the lifeless affect of the characters and by the grinding inevitability of the film's outcome. A more intriguing story structure can be found in Chinese director Siki Song's Sister, in which a boy's remembrance of his younger sister is enacted in stop motion with considerable warmth and some clever visual metaphors, and is punctuated at the end by the reveal that the boy is remembering the sister he would have had, had China not been under the one-child law at the time, forcing the girl's abortion. The only unfortunate thing about this one is not really of director Song's doing, that the tale echoes a particularly manipulative argument of the anti-abortion forces in this country. Song says there's no political intent in her tale, aside maybe from the obvious one that the Chinese law was a tragic attempt at social control, something every side of the argument can agree on, I think, and I take her at her word. If you can put aside the concern over the film being appropriated by people with a decidedly retrograde agenda, this is a sweet and imaginatively visualized tale. Equally sweet is the expected Pixar entry, Kit Bull, which takes the unexpected form of a traditional 2D hand-drawn film, it being the product of the company's Spark Shorts division, which was established to discover new artists and explore new techniques. In telling the tale of a feral and very defensive kitten's relationship with a pit bull being trained for dogfights, directors Rosanna Sullivan and Catherine Hendrickson make great use of juxtaposing the kitten's spindly silhouette and erratic, energetic behavior and its mammoth expressive eyes against the dog's lumbering mass and fearsome set of teeth. Walking a fine line between subtle anthropomorphizing and credible animal behavior, the directors are able to infuse a lot of heart into their opposites attract tale. There's a lot of heart as well in Hair Love, another 2D animated film from an unexpected source, Sony Pictures Animation. Although in this case the crowdfunded project, with some help from the growingly politically aware Dove Soap, seems not to have come from within the studio itself. More lovely metaphoric animation here as an African-American father struggles to tame his young daughter's wild froth of hair, with the hair giving as good as it gets. This is pretty much the only entry this year that provokes genuine laughs, which makes the final reveal of why this hairdo is so important to the girl all the more touching. This one at least left me smiling at the end. The one that had me weeping uncontrollably by the end was the Czech Republic's Desera, English titled Daughter, about a grown woman's deathbed visit to her father and how a wounded bird breaking through the hospital window prompts in both man and daughter memories of their failures to connect. Director Daria Kashiva's stop-motion animation achieves what Memorable failed at, imbuing stoic, animated figures with genuine humanity, both through exquisitely choreographed body language and a unique filming technique that simulates a handheld camera, giving the whole project a real-world rawness that well complements the visual design. In fact, out of all the imagery in this year's slate, the most indelible for me occurs in this film, when the daughter imagines herself as a child transformed into a wounded bird, and Kashiva uses the moment to nail a child's desperation for the reassurance and security of a parent's love. As good as all the films are, this one stands heads and shoulders above the others. It's the one that should win. But because the Academy sometimes has a weakness for efforts that reference classic artists, I suspect Memorable is going to take the award. And let me note that Short.TV is fortifying this selection with 5 additional shorts. I don't know if they were on some sort of shortlist for nominees, short-shortlist for nominees, I don't know, or if they were just selected to fill out the running time, but they're in good company here. Standouts include The Bird and the Whale with lovely paint-on-glass animation, Oars Piste, the only truly flat-out comedic film, and a sardonically comedic one at that, about a med-evac team struggling to get an injured skier down a mountain with an hilarious escalation of perils, and the skier ending up much worse for wear by the end, and Henrietta Bolkowski, an idiosyncratic stop-motion tale of a woman with a deformed back struggling to salvage a crashed airplane so she can fulfill her dream to fly. It isn't hard to figure out the big reveal here, but still, the telling manages to be both naturalistically voice-acted and visually fanciful at the same time. If I had my say, this merited a genuine nomination, much more than Memorable. And just quick, Bong Joon-ho's Parasite is one of the finalists for Oscar Best Picture, and another film I'd been dragging my feet on since his last couple of efforts, Okja, and yeah, even Snowpiercer didn't sit right with me. Well, I've finally seen Parasite, and boy, was I wrong. This tale of an impoverished family who gradually insinuates themselves into the lives of an affluent family, and the repercussions thereof, is fantastic. Caustic, surprising, and brilliantly told. Of the Oscar finalists I've seen, this stands as the best. It probably won't get Best Picture. I'm thinking Joker is going to get that one, but that may be just my perverse nature. But I think it's got a good shot for foreign film. At the very least, its praises are well earned. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
An excellent summary. I have not yet seen Parasite, largely because I've never seen Snowpiercer. I am a little bit leery of, as I often tell people on the air and off the air, I don't like gore. It's not a question of violence. It's I don't care to see dismemberment, oh, what's the word when you see somebody's guts cut out, like happens in Pulp Fiction, things like that. It gives me images that stay with me when I'm trying to go to sleep years later, and costs me sleep. And it's something you can't wash your eyeballs. You can't get rid of that. And as fine as some of these movies may be, when they get that explicit, I can't watch them, or rather, I won't watch them. That's why I gave up on Game of Thrones in the first season, episode 8, during a courtyard battle, and so on and so forth. So I'm a little bit leery because of Snowpiercer, which I know has never been reviewed without the word bloody. Now, there's a difference between the word violent and the word bloody. A James Bond film is violent. A Clockwork Orange is violent. But Snowpiercer and Game of Thrones are bloody. And I think, and it was Dan in an email, I think, who cautioned me that Parasite may, but he hadn't seen Parasite yet. He's only seen it now. So maybe Dan, let me know if, because he can pretty well gauge my tolerance for these things. Because I'd very much like to see it. I have the unusual position of I've seen most of the nominated films, and those that I haven't, I have a copy of, because the other member of my household is a member of the Writers Guild of America, East, and therefore we got screeners. I have never before gotten screeners. We got like 40 different movies. And those that we weren't actually sent discs of, we were given links to. They're actually, those are still good through pretty much right up until the Oscars, although the Writers Guild Awards are all given out before that. But they still want voters to be able to see certain things. And all that. Now, as far as the shorts are concerned, I took a list at what were the nominated shorts. And lo and behold, 3 out of the 5 I found on, two out of the 5 I found on YouTube. And 1 I found freely available on Vimeo. Because, of course, the nominees want their stuff seen as much as possible before the final ballots are actually written. So, but nonetheless, I do advise you to go and see the collection that Shorts.tv, that Dan just reviewed, puts out. This has been going on for years before I ever heard of Shorts.TV. I suspect either a company formed and bought the rights to this, or the people that have been doing this for years incorporated as Shorts.TV. But I have been enjoying the Oscar-nominated shorts sometimes at the IFC Theater. It's been at different theaters over the years. And yes, they always put out more films. They usually have about 10, 9 or 10, while the Oscar nominees are, well, short. This entire year's run runs 85 minutes, according to Glenn Kenny's review in the New York Times. And he said pretty much what Dan said is how down all of these selections are. You know, barely a giggle in the bunch. And yeah, this is something that has been trending since 9/11, really. And in the Trump era, has just gotten worse and worse and worse. So I think it's indicative of the times. On my guess, I think Parasite will win Best Picture. It's just, I'm not saying it is the best picture. I think that's what the Academy will vote for. So we shall see. My choice for Best Film of the Year? Not genre at all. I thought Little Women was incredible. Just brilliant movie making in every way, shape, and form. Oh, one film I haven't seen is Marriage Story, which is ironically by Little Women. It's made by Greta Gerwig, and Marriage Story by Noah Baumbach. In other words, husband and wife. And Noah Baumbach's film is, you know, rather depressing film about divorce. People call it a comedy, and it's like, yeah, I don't know that. I want to go there. I'm really, like, when I sit back, I'm shallow in some ways. I like things that make me think and stir me, and we're going to hear some of that in just a little while. But very often, I just want good old entertainment. And Little Women certainly was that. And it had just brilliant, brilliant moments within it. The movie making is brilliant. And at least it got nominated for a whole lot of things and was omitted. Snubbed is everybody's favorite word. Snubbed for Best Director, which is just utterly ridiculous because this is, what, the sixth version, I believe, of Little Women. There are two silent movies that nobody has access to. Then there's the Katharine Hepburn and the June Allison, then the Winona Ryder, and now the Suarez Ronan, although I prefer to think of it as the Greta Gerwig, because in this case, unlike those others, this one is an auteur film in so many ways. And just brilliantly done. So, all that aside, it's funny, the year that, oh, now I'm blanking. I shouldn't be blanking on the name of the director of The Hurt Locker. I'm going to Google it up because it's totally unfair to her to make reference to that. Come on, where's my browser? No? There it is. Just look up The Hurt Locker. Pardon me for 1 second. Anyhow, the point is that one year, Catherine Bigelow who had been married, and I think by that time was already divorced from James Cameron. And her movie, The Hurt Locker, was up for Best Picture against Titanic. No, not Titanic, Avatar. And so everybody was going, oh, look at that, you know, husband and wife against each other. And we don't like him, but we do like her. Whatever. Whatever. It was totally ridiculous kind of thing. Two gifted people. This was not a contest between the two of them, but people make it that way. I'm very, very pleased that we have a similar thing happening, that both Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig, husband and wife, each have brilliant films out, highly celebrated films out. And people are noting that, well, they often work together. She starred in Frances Ha, which he directed. He calls her his muse. She calls him her muse. This is great and fine. So nothing salient there. No point to be made other than more power to them. We will be doing a show at the end of award season with Dan Persons Live, and we will go through it all and discuss our shared interests and disagreements. I still don't understand why everybody... It's not just Dan. Everybody really has a problem with the last Star Wars film. And I see a lot of the problems with it. And knowing where the original director may have taken it in a wholly fresh new direction, as opposed to the sentimental fan service, let's close it out. I really think those were the two things. I enjoyed the fan service. I think I might have also enjoyed the other, maybe even more. Who knows? Because the other one ain't been made. There will be future Star Wars films, and despite what they say, I'm sure there will be future Skywalker films. And hopefully all of these people are going to have their crack at it. But we'll discuss that in much more detail when we can have Dan as guest and hopefully not get too bogged down. Oh, earlier I had mentioned, this will be our last media thing for this morning, how the beginning of the season of Doctor Who was really disappointing. And it really was. There were some episodes that were, the first two were just uninspiring, the two-part Spyfall. Didn't go anywhere, even though they had a clever thing about the Master. Oops, spoiler, in there. And then after that, episode 3 of this season was just poor. And so on Sunday, I hardly even remembered, oh, Doctor Who is on tonight, because it had sort of lost my usually vast enthusiasm for that show, and I think Jodie Whittaker has been doing just fine with it. And so sat back, not prepared for much, and man, it was great. It was just top notch. That's all. It's back, and it looks like it's setting up the rest of the season to be really good. There was at least one huge surprise, which I really was not expecting, and I'm so glad it happened. There's another surprise that I wish would happen that I don't think will happen, but who knows? They pulled a good one, and it promises a fine arc for the rest of the season. So I'm very pleased to say that Doctor Who is once again fulfilling what I want. Also, just before coming here, watch The Magicians. It's still good. I don't know why it isn't more popular than it is. It's an exceptionally written show with tons of comedy and pathos at the same time. Read the books. They have nothing to do with the movie. The TV series? Watch the TV series. It has little to do with the books. the New Yorker this week. N.K. Jemisin was profiled. Not just, you know, an article about her, but one of the proper New York profiles, New Yorker profiles. And when that happens, that is a major event. I've had some email contact with Nora in the last couple of weeks, but haven't spoken to her since then. And I've almost been afraid to. It's just too thrilling, too great a thing. But I have been saying for a very, very long time that N.K. Jemisin has basically taken on for people, not in terms of her fiction, but for what she represents to writers out there, the mantle that had been brought up by Octavia Butler. And in the last 3 years, Nora's main work has been a specific trilogy, the Broken Earth trilogy, and each and every one of those novels has won the Hugo Award for Best Novel. It was enough that the first novel was the first time a black person, an African-American, won the Hugo for Best Novel. Now, mind you, people get confused about that. It's not the first time they won a Hugo. It's that they won first time an African-American won a Hugo for Best Novel. You know, how they never managed to give one to Samuel R. Delaney, despite Dahlgren and Einstein Intersection and some of the best science fiction novels ever written. How they could not have given one to Octavia Butler is beyond belief. And I'm sure that if they could set up their time machines and go back, that would change. But it is Nora, N.K. Jemisin, who has picked up the pace on that and is finally getting the recognition that such writers deserve, and that she, as an individual, forget the politics of it all, just as an individual, brilliant fantasist, one of the best world builders out there in terms of how she creates her worlds of fantasy, are involved. And very proud to have had her on this show. I don't know how many times, because as a member of the Altered Fluid Writers Group, she was on at least 5 times, maybe 6. As a guest on this program, she's been on 3 or 4 times. And as a reader at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, 2. Well, we're going to hear the latter one of those. This one was held. Let's see. Oh, I better actually get it queued up here. But I do date these things, thank God. I've lost so much of my analog material, but I still have all of my digital stuff, and I date my digital stuff very carefully in the file name. I don't depend on what the computer says when that file was made. So this is from the year 2016, the month 9, the date 27, when Nora Jemisin read with Kai Ashanti Wilson, somebody else very worthy of your attention. But we are going to hear for 49 minutes the reading that Nora did. Before that, you're going to have to bear with me a little more because I introduce her there. Also, by the way, she is the current on the current episode of Lightspeed Magazine podcast. You can go to lightspeedmagazine.com and listen to it there, or if you prefer, read the story. But hey, if you listen to the podcast, I'm the host. I get to introduce it. So there. And Janina Edwards is the narrator on that. She did a brilliant, brilliant job on a not simple story in terms of its structure. I hope Nora listened to it and liked it. So I have not listened to this all the way through, and that was a very, very bizarre and difficult night for me as the producer had kicked off that series of readings for that month. And a lot of stuff was going on, and I won't get into it here. But, he slapped his forehead. I forgot to mention, the next reading is next Tuesday, February 4th, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, right here. Not right here, I'm on the third floor. These will be on the first floor at 388 Atlantic Avenue. In Brooklyn, very, very easy to get to, shockingly easy to get to. We get more trains coming near here than go to Times Square, and that's not just an idle boast. I've checked it out. We do. We even have the Long Island Railroad but a few blocks away. So no excuse not to come, and it will be huge, huge fun. Teal James Glenn, who was our guest on this program last week, and Elizabeth Crowens will be reading stories that have a certain Holmesian steampunk thing going on about them. And it's just going to be tremendous fun, and you should dress up for it. Take out your cyberpunk glasses, your steampunk glasses, or your cyberpunk glasses, if there is such a thing, and a deerstalker cap, and come by to 388 Atlantic Avenue next Tuesday. We begin at 7, so show up about 6:30 so you can meet the readers and get a bite to eat in the cafe, the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. And be set to have a good time. It will be live cast over Facebook Live, but it's not the same as being here. So do show up for that. Okay, so now let's go to that same location that I just mentioned, but set your Wayback Machine to the year 2016 and listen to what occurred that very night. Nora K. Jemisin is an author of speculative fiction, short stories, and novels who lives and writes in Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been nominated for the Hugo 3 times, the Nebula 4 times, and the World Fantasy Award 2 times. I have to interrupt. And okay, this is a few years ago. That those numbers have like doubled. But let me just mention also, I was going to say this earlier. I have not listened to this since that night. I was busy, as I said. It was a very traumatic night in a few ways for totally unrelated reasons. So let me just warn you, just in case, because the radio station, the broadcasting, is pretty much a safe space, but there is also such a thing as safe harbor. And the reading series is not. So just in case a naughty word, a word that some people might consider out of their parlance, is mentioned, you should tune out. In other words, the following 49 minutes contain frank language. May contain frank language. And if this is something that offends you, I suggest you tune out and rejoin us at 3 a.m. for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way. Okay, so now that I've interrupted me, let me interrupt me on recording. Crawford, the Gemmel. The Gemmel Morning Star and The Tip Tree. She has won a Locus Award for Best First Novel, as well as the Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award 2 times. In 2016, she won the Best Novel Hugo for the 5th season. Thereby becoming
almost unbelievably, but very deservedly, the first black writer to win the award in that category. Butler never got it. Delaney never got it in that category. They were Hugo winners, but not for novel. Dahlgren somehow just eluded people. Anything by Butler somehow, well, we won't go on about the Hugos, will we? Finally, let's just say that finally they are catching up to reality. Put there by a bunch of puppies. Well, it's sort of true. That the puppies force people to wake up. Maybe. Let's not go there. The second book in the Broken Earth trilogy, The Obelisk Gate, was just recently released. Not on her bio for some reason, so I added it in. She's also the science fiction book critic for the New York Times. Why I had to add that, I don't know.
I haven't had time to update my blog.
Her short fiction has been published in pro markets such as Clark's World, Postscripts, Strange Horizons, and Bane's Universe, semi-pro markets such as Idiomancer and Abyss and Apex, and podcast markets, mostly Escape Artists?
The Escape Artist Podcast.
Okay, I haven't heard them lumped together like that. That's actually useful. And print anthologies. Her first 7 novels, a novella, and a short story collection are currently in print from Orbit Books. She is currently a member of the Altered Fluid Writing Group. There are so many people in Altered Fluid. That was them all hooting just now. In addition to writing, she has been a counseling psychologist and educator, specializing in career counseling and student development, a sometime hiker and biker, and a political, feminist, anti-racist blogger. Everybody, Nora Jemison.
Okay, just a quick thing. I am, like, unusually sensitive, I guess, to the sound of snapping cameras. So after this, we're going to do a brief photo shoot. So if you guys want to take pictures, you can take pictures to your heart's content as soon as we've finished reading. But please try not to... Well, if you have phones that make snappy noises or flashy things... if you could try not to, like that. Thank you for the demonstration. During the reading, before or after is fine, but during the reading, please, if you could. Anyway, I am going to be reading a story that I am not entirely happy with, that is not entirely finished. So it's going to be real interesting how this works out. But this is a short story that has already been sold, so I'm going to have to fix it soon. to the POC Destroy Fantasy anthology, which will be getting published, I think, in January? I'm not sure about the publication date. So you will hopefully see a finalized, finished, polished version of this at some point in the future. For now, you're going to get the second draft version. Apologies to the folks from Altered Fluid. You have heard the first draft of this. Okay, Red Dirt Witch by N.K. Jemisin. The way to tell the difference between dreams that were prophecy and dreams that were just wasted sleep was to wait and see if they came 3 times. Emmeline had her 3rd dream about the White Lady on the coldest night ever recorded in Alabama history. This was actually very cold, 10 degrees below zero on a long, dark January Sabbath when even the moon hid behind a veil of shadow. Emmeline survived the cold the way poor people everywhere have done since the dawn of time, with a warm, energetic friend. 3 patchwork quilts helped too. The friend was Frank Heath, who was pretty damn spry for a man of 55, though he claimed to be 45, so maybe that helped. The quilts were M's, and it also helped that one of them had dried flowers, Jack in the Pulpits. There we go. Sorry, size issue. Okay. And it also helped that one of them had dried flowers, Jack in the pulpits, and a few nuggets of charcoal tucked under each patch of leftover cloth. That made for a standing invitation to warmth in the summertime, who were, of course, welcome to pay a visit and stay the night any time they liked. Those had come a-calling to the children's beds, at least, for which Emmeline was grateful. The children slept soundly, snug and comfortable. That left Em and Frank free to conduct their own warmth-making with an easy conscience. After that was done, Emmeline closed her eyes and found herself on the commissary market down on Dugan. Dusty southern daylight, bright and fierce even in winter, shone slanting onto the street out alongside the market, unimpeded by cars or carts or people. Pratt City wasn't much of a city, being really just the Negro neighborhood of Birmingham, but it was a whole place, thriving and bustling in its way. Here, though, Emmeline had never seen the place so empty in her life, as if despite the cold, the market's bins tumbled over with summer produce, watermelons and green tomatoes and peaches and more, along with a few early collards. That meant that whatever this dream meant to warn her of, it would come with the heat of the mid-months. Out of habit, Em glanced at the sign above these last. Overpriced again, greedy bastards. "Why, greed's a sin," said a soft, whispery voice all around her. "Be proper of you to punish them for it, wouldn't it?" This was one of the spirits she'd tamed over the years. They liked to test her, though, so it was always wise to be careful with them. "Supposing I could," she said in reply. "But only the store manager, since the company too big to go after. And I can't say as I blame the manager either, since he got children to feed, same as me."
"Sin, sin, woman."
"And let she who is without sin cast the first stone," Em countered easily, "as you well know." Then she checked herself. No sense getting testy. Ill-wishing opened doors for ill winds to blow through, which was probably why the voice was trying to get her to do it. Anyway, sorry. The voice sighed a little in exasperation. It was colorless, genderless, barely a voice at all. That sigh whispered like wind through the stand of pines across the street.
"Just telling you somebody coming, cranky old biddy."
"Who, Jesus Christ? About time, his slow ass." Whispery laughter.
"Fine, then. The white lady are coming, a fine one, and she got something special in mind for you and yours. You ready?"
Em frowned to herself. The other two dreams had been more airy-fairy than this, just collections of symbols and hints of a threat, omens and portents. It seemed fate had finally gotten impatient enough to just plain say what she wanted to hear, what she needed to hear. "No, I ain't ready," Em said with a sigh. "But ain't like that ever made no mind to some folk. Thank you for the warning." More laughter, rising to become a gale, picking Emmeline up and spinning her about. The market blurred into a whirlwind, but through it all there were little ribbons that she could see edging out into the tornado from elsewhere, whipping about in shining silken red. Truth was always there for the taking if you only reached out to grasp it. Thing was, Em didn't feel like grasping it. She was tired, Lord have mercy. The world didn't change. If she just relaxed, the dream would let her back into sleep like she wanted. But, well, best to be prepared, she supposed. So Em stretched out a hand and laid hold of one of the ribbons. And suddenly the street that ran through the market was full of people, angry people, most of them white and lining the road, and marching people, most of them black and in the middle of the road. The black ones' jaws were set, their chins high in a way that always meant trouble when white folks were around, because, Lord, didn't they hate seeing pride.
"Trouble, trouble," sang song the voice,
and before the marchers appeared a line of policemen with billy clubs in their hands and barking dogs at their sides. Emmeline's guts clenched for the blood that would almost surely be spilled. Pride. Was it worth all that blood? Yet when she opened her mouth to shout at the marchers for their foolishness, the whispery voice laughed again, and she spun again, the laughter chasing her out of dreams and up to reality. Well, this was what she'd wanted, but she didn't much like it because reality was dark and painfully cold on her mouth and chin, which she'd stuck outside the covers to breathe. Her teeth were chattering. She reached back.
"Ain't time to get up," muttered Frank at her stirring, half dreaming himself.
You got Sunday to rest, said Emmeline. You want to live till then, you get to work. His low, rich laugh warmed her more than his body ever could have. Yes, ma'am, he said, and did as he was bid. And because they had set to, Emmeline missed that her only girl child, Pauline, got up and walked the hall for a while, disturbed by bad dreams of her own. Since the spirits had given her a full season's warning, Em spent the time preparing for the White Lady's arrival. This meant she finished up as much business as possible in the days right after the dream. The cold passed quickly, as cold was wont to do in Alabama. And as soon as the weather was comfortable again, Emmeline set Pauline to grinding all the herbs she'd laid in since November, and then had her boy Sample put her shingle out by the mail post, where it read, "Herbs and prayers for all and sundry." This brought an immediate and eager stream of customers. First, there was Mr. Jake, who'd gotten into a spat with his cousin over Christmas dinner and had wished death on him, and now was regretting it because the cousin had come down with a wet cough. Emmeline told him to take the man some chitlins made with sardine oil and extra garlic. Then she handed him a long braid of garlic heads, 10 in all, from her own garden. That much garlic? Jake had given her a look of pure affront. Like most men of Pratt City, he was proud of his cooking. Now look Italian to you? All right, let him die then. This elicited a giggle from Pauline, who sat in on most of Em's appointments these days. So, grumbling, Jake had brought the garlic from Emmeline and gone off to make his amends. People talked about Jake's stanky, awful chitlins till the day he died. But his cousin ate some of the peace offering, and he got better. And then there was Em's cousin Renee, who came by just to chat and conveniently told Emmeline all the goings-on in and around Pratt City. There was trouble brewing, Renee said. Political trouble. Whispers in the church pews, meetings in the school gym, plans for a boycott or two or ten. Way up in Virginia, folks were suing the government about segregation in the schools. Em figured it wouldn't come to nothing, but all the white folks was up like angry bees over the notion of their precious children sitting next to Negro children, competing next to Negro children, befriending Negro children. It was going to get ugly. Many evils came riding in on the tales of strife, though, so here, Emmeline suspected, would be their battleground. Then there was Nadine Yates, a widow who, like Emmeline, had done what she had to keep herself and her children alive through the cold and not-so-cold days. Nadine was afraid she might be pregnant again. I know it's a sin, she said in her quiet, dignified voice while Emmeline fixed her some tea. For this one, she'd sent Pauline off to the market with her brothers. Pauline was still just a girl, and some things were for grown women's ears only. Still, if you could help me out, I'd be grateful. Sin's making a world where women got to choose between two children eating and three children starving, Emmeline said, and you sure as hell didn't do that. You made sure he wasn't some fool who spread it all over, didn't you? He got a wife and a good job, and he ain't stupid. Gave my boys new coats last week. A man who knew how to keep a woman on the side properly. But then, wouldn't it be simple enough for him to just take care of the new child, too? Emmeline frowned as a suspicion entered her mind. He white? Nadine's nearer jaw flexed a little, and then she lifted her chin in fragile defensiveness. He is. Emmeline sighed, but then nodded toward the tea cooling in Nadine's hand. Drink up now. And it sounds like he can afford a guinea hen to me. So a few days later, after the tea had done its work, Nadine dropped by and handed Emmeline a nice fat guinea fowl. It was a rooster, but Em didn't mind. She pot-roasted it with dried celery and a lot of rosemary from her garden, and the rind of an orange that Pauline had found on the road behind a market truck. Emmeline had smacked the girl for that, because even though finding wasn't stealing, white folks didn't care much for making distinctions when it came to little colored girls. But Pauline, who was smart as a whip and Em's pride, had glared at her mother after the blow. Mama, I followed the truck to a stop sign and offered to give it back. I knew the white man wouldn't want it because I touched it, and he didn't, so there. Smart as a whip, but still just a child and innocent yet of the world's worst ugliness. Emmeline could only sigh and thank God the truck driver hadn't been the kind who'd have noticed how pretty Pauline was becoming. As an apology for the smack, she'd let Pauline have half the orange, while the boys each got only a quarter. Then she sat the girl down for a long talk about how the world worked. And so it was. As the brief winter warmed toward briefer spring and began the long, slow march into southern summer, by the time the tomato plants flowered, Em was as ready as she could be. "Oh, Miss Emmeline," called a voice from outside. An instant later, Jim and Sample, Emmeline's boys, ran into the kitchen. "It's a red lady outside," Sample gushed. "Well, go figure," Emmeline said. "Ain't like you ain't a quart o' red yourself." Her papa had been Black Creek, his hair uncut till death. "Not that kind of red," said Sample, rolling his eyes enough to get a hard look from Emmeline. "She asking for you." "Is she now?" Emmeline turned from the pantry and handed Sample a jar of peach preserves. "Open that for me and you can have some." Delighted to be treated like a man, Sample promptly sat down and began wrestling with the tight lid. "I don't like this one," said Jim. And since Jim was her artist, none of the dreaming in him, but he saw things others didn't, Emmeline knew the time had come. She wiped her hands on a cloth and went out onto the porch to meet the white lady. She smelled the lady before she saw her, a thick waft of magnolia perfume, too cloying to be quite natural. Outside, the perfume wasn't as bad, diminished and blended in among the scents of Em's garden and the faint sulfurous miasma that was omnipresent in Pratt City on still days like this. That was from Village Creek, polluted as it was with nearly a century's worth of iron and steel waste. The woman to whom the perfume belonged stood on the grassy patch in front of Em's house, fastidiously away from the red dirt path that most people walked to reach her front porch. Why, this lady was just as pretty as a flower, in a full-skirted dress of cotton print, yellow covered in white and green lilies. No crinoline, but nearly as old-fashioned, with layers separated by bunched taffeta and edged in lace. Around the heart-shaped bodice, her skin was white as pearl, so white that Em figured she'd have burned up in a minute if not for the enormous parasol positioned over her head. And here was why Sample had called her red. The confection of her hair, spun into an elegant chignon behind her head and topped with a crown of white flowers, was nearly as burgundy as good wine. It was all Em could do not to feel inadequate, given that she wore only an old faded house dress, with her own hair done up in plaits and hidden away beneath a wrap. But she drew herself up anyway and reminded herself that she needed no parasol to keep her skin fine. The sun did that itself, and black didn't crack beneath its blessing. Those were just surface things anyway. The white lady was nearly all surface. That was the nature of her kind. That was how this meeting would go then, an appearance of grace and gentility covering the substance of battle. "Why, I've come to see about you, Miss Emmeline," the white lady said, as if they were in the middle of a conversation and not the beginning. Her voice was light and sweet, as honeyed as her yellow eyes. "You know me." "Yes, ma'am," Em said, because she knew the children were watching, and it wouldn't do for them, especially the boys, to think they could smart off to white ladies, even if this one really wasn't a white lady. "Heard here and there you were coming." "Did you now?" She simpered, dimples flashing, and flecked at her skirts. As she did this, Em caught a glimpse of a figure behind her. A little black girl, couldn't have been more than seven, crouched and holding the pole of the great big parasol over the woman's head. The little girl's feet were bare beneath the simple white shift she wore, and her eyes were still and empty. "I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that you heard," the white lady said, unfolding a little lace fan and fluttering it at herself. "Figured you'd have your ways. Could I trouble you for some tea or lemonade, though, Miss Emmeline? It's always almighty hot in this land. Not that that bothers your kind like it does mine." "Mighty hot indeed," Emmeline agreed evenly. She nodded to Pauline, who stood beside her, trembling a little. Even a half-trained girl child knew power when she saw it. Pauline jumped, but went inside. "This land made its natural people brown for a reason, though, ma'am, long before either your nor most of mine came across. Seems to me you could make yourself fit the land better if you wanted, of course." The woman extended one long, thin arm and ran her fingers up the pearly skin, looking almost bemused to find such flesh upon herself. "I should, I suppose, but you know there's more reward than price comes with this skin." Em did indeed know. "Pauline's gone to fetch some tea for you, ma'am. No lemonade, I'm afraid. Lemons cost too dear when you got three children and no husband, see." "Ah, yes, about these children of yours. As much as Emmeline thought she had braced herself, she still couldn't help tensing up when the white lady's yellow eyes shifted to dance over the faces of Jim and Sample. Lord, but she should have guessed. America wasn't the old country. These days the white folk didn't bother with silly tricks or living in mounds, and they didn't stay hidden, for why should they? But the one thing they still did, in spades here in this land of cheap flesh, was steal children. And if they kept the children of a certain hue, why, the police didn't even ask after them. Emmeline set her jaw. The woman's eyes lingered on Jim long enough to be worrying. Jim, smart one that he was, had gone still and quiet, looking down at his feet, knowing better than to meet any woman, white woman's gaze. Sample was all a bristle, not liking the way the woman was eyeballing his little brother. Ah, damnation, Emmeline never should have picked for Sample's father a man who liked to fight. Boy was going to get himself in trouble one day. Em had a feeling, though, that this was a feint. And when Pauline came back onto the porch with a big sweating glass of iced tea, and sure enough, the white lady's gaze landed on the girl with much more than greed for a cool drink. Pauline stopped there with her eyes narrowed, because like Emmeline, she knew what was beneath the surface. The woman laughed prettily at the look on the girl's face. "Trouble come and tell," the white lady sang, still grinning. "Trouble come and find, not to pay the price, but sweet blood like fine wine." She had a beautiful voice, like me. She had a beautiful voice, lilting and hymn reverberant and high as the birds flew. Hardly sounded human, in fact, which was fitting enough. Em raised a hand in praise anyway because beauty was meant to be acknowledged, and to deny it would just invite her further in. "Trouble always coming, ma'am," she replied to the song. "Some of us, this world made a trouble, not that you folk help." "Oh, Miss Emmeline, don't be like that. Come on here, girl, with that tea. It's powerful hot." Em glanced at Pauline. Pauline nodded once, tightly. Then she walked to the step down to the steps to the bottommost slab, no further, and held forth the glass. The white lady sighed, throwing a look at Em. "Ought to raise your children to show some respect, Miss Emmeline." "Lots of ways to show respect, ma'am." The white lady sniffed. Then she turned her head, and the little girl who had been holding the parasol straightened and came around her. The parasol stayed where it was, holding itself up against the ground. As the child moved forward, Em's skin came all over goosebumps. Wasn't right, seeing a child who should have been so lively, so empty of life and magic. The little girl twitched a little while she walked, as if with a palsy, or as if jerked on strings. She stopped before Pauline and held her hands up, and Em didn't blame Pauline at all for her grimace as she pushed the glass into the child's hands. "Whose was she?" Emmeline asked, as the little girl twitched and moved to bring the tea back to her mistress. "Nobody who matters, Miss Em, don't you mind?" The white lady took the glass of tea, then smoothed a hand over the child's soft cap of hair with an almost fond smile. "Such a lovely girl, though, isn't she? Everybody says you folk can't be beautiful, but that's just not true. Where else would I be able to get this?" She preened, smoothing a hand over one unblemished, shining cheek. "She had power," Pauline said. Em started. She was used to Pauline keeping her mouth shut around white folks like a good, sensible girl should. But Pauline was still staring at the little girl in horror. Her expression hardened, though, from shock to disgust. "She had power, and you took it. Like a damn thief." The white lady's eyebrows looked to have climbed into her red hair for a moment. Emmeline was right there with her, shocked at Pauline's cheek. She snapped without thinking, "Pauline, Elizabeth, shut your mouth before I shut it." Pauline shut up, though Emmeline could see the resentful flex of muscle along her jaw. But the white lady let out a soft laugh, chilling them both into silence. "Well, I can't say I think much of how you're raising your children, Miss Emmeline. Negro children never can sit still and be quiet, I suppose. Of course I took her power, girl. It's not like she could do anything with it. Now, I think I'm owed an apology, don't you?" "Damnation." Stiffly, Emmeline said, "I'm sorry for my daughter's foolishness, ma'am. I'll see to her when we're done talking." "Oh, but that isn't enough, Miss Em." The white lady tilted her head, long red lashes catching the light. "Honestly, how's she going to learn respect if you do all the apologizing for her?" Pauline spoke tightly with a darting glance at Emmeline for permission to speak. "I'm sorry too, ma'am." "Now see, that wasn't so hard." The white lady gestured with the tinkling glass of tea at Pauline, beaming. But don't you think you owe me a bit more after smarting off like that? Why, I'm wounded. You called me a thief. And even if I am, it's the principle of the thing. She stepped forward. I think you should come with me for a while and learn respect, don't you? No, ma'am, Emmeline snapped before Pauline could dig herself further into trouble. I don't think she owes you a thing beyond what you've had. Oh, now be reasonable. The white lady stepped forward once more, almost to the porch steps, but then she paused, her smile fading just a little. When she glanced off to the side, she spied the rosemary bush at last, growing scraggly in the summer heat. Growing, though, still, and by its growth weaving a bit of protection around the house. Beginning to frown, the woman glanced to the other side. There was plenty of sage, too, thriving in the heat, unlike the rosemary. Eyes widening, the woman finally turned about, spying at last the prize of Emmeline's yard, the sycamore fig. It grew in an arc over on the far side of the yard because many years ago some neighborhood children had played on it and nearly broken its trunk. It had survived, though, through the heat, through the breaking, and through the isolation, for it was nearly the only one of its kind in America. By the stories Emmeline's own mother had told of its planting, the seed fig had been smuggled over from Africa herself, tucked into some poor soul's womb to keep it safe and living through the Middle Passage. "Supposed to be rowan, thorn, and ash," said the white lady. All at once she sounded sulky. Emmeline lifted her chin. "That'd work, too," she said. "Because Lord knows I got some Scots-Irish in me from my poor slave foremother's travails. But this ain't the soil of ire. Red Alabama dirt roots different protectors. And you ain't the same as yourn back in the old country, neither. Not after all these years of drinking Negro blood, so rosemary, sage, and fig will do for you." The white lady let out a huffy little sound, but then she took a dainty step back. She started to raise the glass of tea, then paused, focusing sharply on it. Her lip curled, then she glared at Pauline. "Just a little bit of acorn flour, ma'am," Pauline said, with such exaggerated innocence in her voice that Emmeline had to stifle a smile in spite of herself. "For flavor." "Rosemary, sage, and fig to bind," said the white lady. It was clear now that she was furious as she held the glass of tea out from herself and then dropped it. The tea spilled onto the grass and the glass split into three pieces. She drew in a deep breath, visibly mastering her temper. "And oak to strike the blow. Well, Miss Emmeline, I'll grant you one this one. But it leaves us in a bit of a fix. You can't keep yours safe everywhere, and I can't be chasing after them all damn day and night." She thought a moment. "How about a deal?" "Ain't enough water in the River Jordan," Emmeline snapped. "Sure." The white lady's grin crept back like a dog badly banished. "Safety and prosperity for the rest, if you give me but one." "I done told you no," Emmeline said. She was forgetting to pretend polite. Well, Sample hadn't gotten it only from his father. "How many more times I got to..." "What kind of safety?" asked Pauline. "Lord have mercy, I'm going to have to kill this girl," Emmeline could not help muttering. But Pauline had set her jaw in that tight, stubborn way that meant she didn't care if she got a smack for it. She persisted. "How much prosperity?" Oh, and if that didn't spread the white lady's grin neatly from ear to ear. "Why, lots, sugar. Bless your heart." "Girl, shut your mouth," Emmeline snapped. But the white lady held up a hand, and all at once Emmeline found herself unable to speak. Oh, mercy, Em knew then. Stupid, stupid girl. "Pauline, don't," blurted Jim. But the white lady eyed him too, and he was shut up as firmly as Emmeline herself. Sample just stared from one to the other of his siblings to the white lady, his hands flexing as if he wanted to hit somebody, but wasn't sure where to start. "Children should be seen and not heard," said the white lady, gesturing gracefully with her fan. Ooh, typo. Okay. Sorry. "But ladies, with that blood like wine, sweet and high and so fine, get some choices in the matter till it's taken from them. What do you say, Ms. Pauline?" Pauline, to her credit, glanced at Emmeline again. Her belligerence had faded by now, and her small face was properly anxious and afraid. Then, too, her jaw firmed, and she faced the white lady squarely. "You said trouble was coming." "Oh, indeed. The white lady let her gaze drip left and right, syruping all over the boys.
So much trouble. Folks getting uppity from here to the Carolinas. Desegregation. Non-discrimination. And don't you know them bullnecks will be hitting back fast, beating y'all back into your place.
She stopped her gaze on hot-headed Sample. Sample set his jaw.
Hitting back hard, I tell you, on boys who think to be called men.
Pauline caught her breath. Then, though, thank the Lord, she bit her bottom lip. I want to speak to my mother. There was a moment's long, pent pause. Then the white lady flipped her fan back up into a blurring wave, dropping back into a mocking curtsy. The servant child moved jerkily back behind her, taking hold of the parasol again.
Seeking counsel is wise and within the rules besides, the white lady admitted. Not too much counsel, though, little miss. Some deals don't last long.
With that, she flounced off with the child in tow, though Emily noted that she skirted wide around the sycamore fig before passing through a pine tree, behind a pine tree and vanishing. The instant Emmeline could speak and move, she did, hurrying over to Pauline and slapping the tar out of the girl before she could speak.
Didn't I tell you about folks like that? She demanded, pointing with a shaking hand after the white lady. Didn't I tell you they'll put a pretty orange in your hand and snatch it back with the hand attached?
It had been happening more and more lately that Pauline defied her, but then this was only proper, was it not? A girl coming into her womanhood and her adult power should speak her mind sometimes.
I know, Mama, Pauline said, without a trace of apology.
Her voice was so calm and strong that even Emmeline blinked.
But I had dreams. Well, you should have told me. And you should have told me about the blood coming. I know how to make you safe for at least a bit of time, and you can't make me safe, Mama.
Pauline said it so sharp, her gaze so hard, that Emmeline could only flinch back.
That's why you told me to be scared. That's why you told me what to be scared of, ain't it? So I could make myself safe. And I know, because you taught me, that it's a woman's job to fight for what's hers.
That's a man's job, Jim said, scowling. Though he too should have been quiet, cowed by the slap. Sample nodded fiercely. Emmeline groaned and put a hand in the air for strength. All of her children had forgotten how to mind all at once.
Decent folks' job, then, Pauline said back with a little heat. But, Mama, I saw it in the dream. People marching, big old redneck bulls standing up like men, holding dogs and billy clubs, blood everywhere.
Emmeline's skin went all a prickle with remembered fear. Yet there was no fear in Pauline's face as she went on, her voice rising in excitement.
At the end of it, though, Mama, at the end, I saw white children and black children sitting by each other in school. It was yellow and brown and red children there, too. Black people at the front of a bus.
Mama, Pauline bit her lip, then leaned forward to whisper, though there was no one to hear it but family.
I saw a black man in a big white house.
There were always black men in the big white houses of downtown Birmingham. Who else was going to tend their gardens or wash their cars? And yet, there was a fervor in Pauline's gaze that warned Emmeline there was something more to her daughter's dreams. Didn't matter, though. The world didn't change, and somebody had to protect her fool children from themselves. Seething with pent-up anger and fear, Emmeline herded the children inside. She made them go to bed early with no supper for smarting off, because they had to learn, Pauline especially. Wasn't no prosperity worth a girl child's soul and what little innocence life allowed her? Wasn't no safety for black boys beyond what humility bought them, little as that was. And while they slept, Emmeline burned sage, and she prayed to every ancestor of three continents who might listen, and then she set herself up in a chair before the door with her grandmother's old musket across her knees. She would stay up day and night, if she had to, for her children's sake. After a few hours had passed in slow and taut silence, and the candles burned low, and the weight of drowsiness pressed on the back of her head like a blanket, Emmeline got up to keep herself awake. She peeked in the boys' room. They were snoring, curled up, though Jim had a half-eaten peach still in his hand, sneaked out from some hiding place or another against just such an occasion of their mother's wrath. Pauline's room, though, was cold from the open window, wafting sharp, bitter wind over the girl's empty bed. Just realized that's a typo, too. Fix that. Okay. I'm going to pause here. We've got about 15 minutes worth more of reading. Raise your hand if you are okay with continuing. If you would like to pause. Oh,
okay.
There was only one place the girl could have gone, the fairgrounds in the shadow of Red Mountain. Emmeline ran to Renee's house, since Renee had the only working phone on the street. There she called Frank, who came over bringing his mule. The mule ran like it knew what was at stake, so fast and hard that Emmeline's bottom was raw long before she reached the place. The fairgrounds were only fairgrounds once a year. The rest of the time it was just a fallow field, occasionally used for harness racing. Long ago, though, it had been the breaking ground of a plantation, the place where new slaves, freshly force-marched up from the port of Mobile, got branded and stripped of name and spirit before being sent into the fields. As Emmeline halted the mule and slid off its back, she felt all that old blood there in the ground mixed in with old tears and the red dirt beneath her feet. White folk fed on that sort of magic. This would be a place of power for them. As Em reached the top of the hill, she saw that Pauline stood beneath a pine that was being strangled by a carpet of kudzu. Before her stood the white lady, shining even more now, her skin catching the moon's gleam in the way of her people, ears gone to points and mouth too wide and sharp and full of sharp fangs. They both turned as Emmeline thumped up, out of breath, her legs shaking from holding so tight to the mule's sides. Still, she moved to stand between them in front of Pauline and facing the white lady. I ain't gonna let you.
Deal's done, Miss Emmeline, said the white lady, looking amused. Too late.
Emmeline turned to Pauline, shaking, horrified. Pauline, though, lifted her chin.
I saw it, Mama, she said. One life for three. Trouble coming whether we want it or not, but if I go, you and the boys will get through it.
In a wordless fury, Emmeline flung herself at the white lady. She did this without using her body, and the white lady met her without hers, taking her up and out and through and into dreaming. Thing was, dreaming wasn't a thing mortal folks did so well when they were awake, so Emmeline tumbled, helpless, lashing out ineffectually. And in the perverse way of her kind, who loved to lie but liked it best of all when truth became their weapon, the white lady showed Emmeline the future that Pauline had bought. She saw markets full of melons and greens and peaches, all artificially fresh and reeking of chemicals in the dead of winter. Long elevated strips of road carving up Negro towns and neighborhoods all over the country. Gray looming schools isolating bright black minds and breaking their spirits and funneling them into jails. Police everywhere, killing and killing and killing. This, Emmeline fought nausea and despair, lest she strengthen her enemy. But it was nearly impossible not to feel something. Oh, Lord, her baby had given up her freedom for this. And yet, all at once, Emmeline was not alone in her tumbling. Pauline, new and raw and woman-strong, pushed at Emmeline, helping her straighten up. Then Pauline pointed, snatching more truth from the white lady's dream than even she wanted shown. The white lady hissed into their minds like ice on a griddle. Pauline ignored this and said, "Look, Mama." And then Emmeline saw the rest. Marching black people attacked by dogs, but still marching. Children, sample, struck by the blasts of fire hoses, the torrent peeling off clothes and tearing skin, still marching. Joined by dozens, hundreds, thousands, hundreds of thousands, still marching. Before these marches, prayers and church plate dinners, Emmeline sprinkling a little fire into the chicken and dumplings to warm the marchers against the cold hose water to come. Young women refusing to be ordered out of their bus seats to go sit in the back, Emmeline braiding a donkey's stubbornness into their hair. Children holding their heads high through crowds of shouting, jeering white teenagers and adults. Emmeline trimming a few figs from the sycamore to make jam, sweetening the children's mouths with the taste of heritage and survival. And so much more. Brown faces in space. Emmeline could only stare at the stars and savor the impossible possibility. Brown men on the Supreme Court. Then she saw the White House that Pauline had mentioned, the White House, nestled amid statues and obelisks and the mirror pool of Washington, D.C., a place of power in itself. She saw a man standing on its steps, brown as fig jam, and then a woman black as molasses, her gaze hard and high and proud, and then another woman and another brown man, and so many more, their frequency increasing with the spinning of the sun. Still marching. never stopping till freedom was won. Pauline's single sacrifice could set all of it in motion, but... No! Emmeline fought her way back toward wakefulness. I can't. It can't be me who stays. She didn't believe. She had taught her children to bow their heads, not lift them up high. I'm not what they need. You gonna be all they get, sugar, said the white lady into the dream with a laughing whisper. No. No, she damn well would not be. The dream still spun around her. Emmeline set her jaw and plunged her hand into it, grabbing wildly this time and pulling back the jar of sycamore jam. Sin, sin, she snapped. The top of the jar was tight, but she wrestled it off and plucked out a dripping, soft sycamore fig to brandish against the churning dark. A deal's a deal, but one kind of prey is the same as another to you, ain't it? You like children's beauty, but a woman's don't hurt you none. You like innocence, but you'll take foolishness. So here's mine. I can't believe the world will ever change. I can't hope. It ain't in me. Spent too long making it easier for people to live downtrodden. I know how to survive, but I ain't got the fight for change in me. Not like my baby does. So take me and leave her. No, Pauline shouted, but Emmeline had enough control to drown her out with the sound of chanting marching crowds. The shape of the white lady had blurred into the dream, but she was still a sharp-toothed presence amid the swirl. Take you both, child and fool, all mine. Emmeline grinned. Greed's a sin. The dream cracked a little beneath good Christian truth, allowing Em to summon the whiff of burned sage. The white lady flinched, hard enough to slow the whirlwind of the dream, for the smell carried with it lamentations for stolen lands, stolen children, and the stolen lives of Em's Creek forebears. Emmeline set that in place opposite the jar of figs. Your bargain was one for three, not two for two. Images of marchers warped and twisted all around them, the White House dissolving into the foxy face of the white lady. True enough, she said, conjuring up her fan again. Still, I'd rather...
Oh my gosh, you all right?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
All right, see, this is what happens when you invite bad magic in. Anybody got some sage or some salt to sprinkle? Nobody's hurt, right?
No.
Okay, good. For folks listening at home, we almost had a very bad accident. Okay, so where was I? Something about... Oh, yes, yes, okay. Still, I'd rather the child if you didn't mind, or even if you do. Here, Emmeline faltered. She had not dreamt of Rosemary. Frantically, she rifled through images, tossing away the fish she'd dreamt of before each of her children, shoving aside the green tomatoes and collards of the market. Lord, had she never once dreamt of baking chicken? She had not. But then, through the tittering laughter of the white lady and her cronies, Emmeline smelled a dream of pot-roasted guinea rooster with orange peel and rosemary. That had been the first time Emmeline accorded her daughter the respect of a fellow woman. Oh, and Pauline had been savoring that feeling all this time. There was a bit of innocence attached to it, too, lost after Emmeline's explanation about white men's oranges. The perfect sweetening to lure in hungry Fay. And indeed, the white lady paused, lifting her face a little and half-closing her eyes in pleasure at the toothsome aroma. But then she stiffened as she caught the rosemary's perfume. Rosemary, sage, and fig, said Pauline in a tone of satisfaction. Now let my mama... Take me, Emmeline said, commanded now, because she could. She had bound the white lady by both the ancient rules of the old country and the newer rules of flesh and blood. The deal had been made, one innocent life for three lives protected and prosperous, but Emmeline had control over which life the white men got to keep, and at least. Mama! Pauline, her beautiful, powerful Pauline, abruptly resolved out of the dream's swirl and turned to her. Mama, you can't! Hush. Emmeline went to her, held her close, kissed her corn-rowed head. I done told you a million times that the world doesn't change, but I was wrong. And I'm sorry for that. You got a big fight ahead of you, but you can win it. And you're better suited to that fight than I'll ever be. She hugged the girl tight. Be strong, baby. Tell your brothers the same. I know y'all are anyway. Pauline clutched at her. But Mama, you can't. I didn't want... The white lady closed the dream around Emmeline and whisked her away. In the morning, Pauline woke up on the ground of the fairgrounds, wet with dew and weeping. Her brothers, who had come up to the fairgrounds to find her, came quietly to her side to hold her tight. Sorry, just about enough tempo. Okay. Cousin Renee took the children in, of course, for blood was blood. She sent them one by one to Alabama State for their learning, so they were there when the Freedom Rides began. Naturally, all three joined up. Through the dark times that followed, the foretold dogs and hoses and beatings, and the unforeseen lynchings and assassinations and bombings, there were white folk aplenty doing evil, but no white folk. The Fae did not go again where they had been bested once, and in any case, their time was waning. The dirt of Alabama was red for many reasons, not the least of which is that it was full of iron ore. It took a lot of power to overcome that much iron. And the times were changing such that not even black children could be stolen with impunity anymore. The white folk kept their promise, at least. Jim got his arm bitten by a dog during a protest, but it did not tear his throat out. Hard-headed Sample dated a white woman and only had to flee town. The men who meant to chain him up behind their truck and drag him to death did not catch him. Pauline got married, dreamt of fish, and made her own daughters to carry on the family legacy. After a few more years, she ran for city council and won, and nobody strung her up. Then she ran for mayor and won that, too. All the while, she turned a tidy profit from her sideline barbecue business. The Greens had a little extra warmth in them that made everyone feel a bit better towards each other, so she called them Freedom Greens, mostly as a joke. But one year, the black man Pauline had dreamt of in the White House passed through town, and he decided to come all the way to Pratt City to have some of Pauline's famous Freedom Greens. Folk went wild. Somebody paid her to write a book about her life. Someone optioned the film rights. Companies called and asked to franchise her recipe, but Pauline said no, instead hiring a small staff of Pratt City dwellers and leasing a commercial kitchen to fill all the thousands of orders of greens for herself. In every can, mind, there was a sprinkle of rosemary, sage, and a tiny dab of sycamore fig, just to cut the bitterness. And late one winter's night, Pauline dreamt again of the white folk. She saw how lean and poorly they were looking these days, deprived of their easy prey, and as the hate of the world dwindled and left them hungry. But she fought the urge to smile at their misfortune, for ill-wishing would only make them stronger. She caught a glimpse of a painfully familiar black face among their foxy whiteness. Strong and proud and shining in its own way. A face that was smiling and satisfied and full of motherly pride. So the world changed. And so Pauline woke up and went to hug her oldest daughter close, whispering to her of secrets and savory things and dreams yet to come, and of great Grammy M, never to be forgotten, who would one day also be free. Yeah.
You have been listening to N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, reading a short story that was published not too long after. That was from 2016, September of 2016, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and was published in People of Color Destroy Fantasy, which there was a whole series of destruction modules that went through Lightspeed Magazine, where I do audio editing for the podcast version. And there were POC Destroy Science Fiction, then POC Destroy Fantasy, then POC Destroy Horror. And then the next year was Queers Destroy Fantasy, Science Fiction, and Horror. And oh, we had a third group that at the moment, which it was evades me, but it doesn't matter. But that one was for POC Destroys Fantasy, and you can find that by going to lightspeedmagazine.com and looking through their various tables of content. And you will find them. All those stories are freely online, although they have ways of making you pay. And most of those stories also, half of the stories, exactly half, were turned into podcasts. And I don't think I didn't host all of those, but in a couple of cases, I hired the hosts and did the editing work. I did the editing work on all of them, the audio editing work. I have to be very clear about that because it is, after all, a magazine. And so when you say that you're working on editing something, that sounds like it's a magazine, I have to make it clear, no. I do post-production. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and webcasting over WBAI.org. And for more information about N.K. Jemisin, in case you weren't aware, pick up the current issue of The New Yorker, where she is, I think it's the January 20th is the cover. It's Wednesday. It may now be last week's issue of The New Yorker, but it was the one that on the cover said it was January 20th. And what's more, go to thenewyorker.com, and you can find it, for that matter. Go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, and I've linked to that article there as by way of tonight's show. So, this is indeed Hour of the Wolf, and my name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And I timed things out better than I thought I would, so we actually have a bit of time left. So I think I'm going to play a cut of music just because it's nice when you have all of this talk to occasionally break it up with, well, something more musical, right? Okay, and it will have to be, of course, from the Kingston Trio to commemorate Bob Shane. And, that album sold out. God, it's amazing how I know every last one of these songs. And it's been so long. I mean, that's a 1960 album. Where's, I think my favorite one was from the, there it is, from The Hungry Eye. And I'm sure I can find something, worthwhile. Okay. Let's go for one of their more humorous numbers. Not the MTA. Everybody knows the MTA. But will he ever return? Oh, he'll never return. But here's one written by, of all people, Sheldon Harnick.
Time limits us right now, and this actual number that we're going to play now will be featured in our next album. The Kingston Trio plays John Foster Dulles.
Fly with me.
There's a joke whose time is gone.
They're rioting in Africa. They're starving in Spain. There's hurricanes in Florida. And Texas needs rain. The whole world is festering with unhappy souls. The French hate the Germans. The Germans hate the Poles. Italians hate Yugoslavs. South Africans hate the Dutch.
And I don't like anybody very much.
But we can be tranquil and thankful and proud. poor man's been endowed with a mushroom-shaped cloud. And we know for certain that some lovely day someone will set the spark off, and we will all be blown away. They're rioting in Africa. There's strife in Iran. What nature doesn't do to us will be done by our fellow man.
A classic. The Merry Minuet. I've known that song since I was like 10, and which is about when that particular recording was made. And because I had it there, and I looked it up, and I saw that it was written by Sheldon Harnick. Sheldon Harnick, the man who wrote Fiddler on the Roof? Really? Okay. Well, he didn't write it in Yiddish anyway. If you would like to call up and talk things science fiction or media related stuff like that, there spoilers from The Magicians. Well, we shouldn't do too many of those. Doctor Who, yeah, let's talk Doctor Who and various things, or just what have you been reading? Give us a call at area code 212-209-2877. Again, 212-209-2877, and we can converse together. So let's see, what else have I had on my agenda? Well, yes, let me repeat that we have another edition of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings coming up this Tuesday, February 4th, with Elizabeth Crowan and Teal James Glenn, who is on the program next week, and Elizabeth is going to be on in like 2 or 3 weeks. And it will be fantasy Sherlock Holmes related. So be prepared to, if you like, dress up for that. Wear some steampunk type stuff with a deerstalker hat, and you're all set. Admission is free. Donations are cajoled for. And again, this is coming Tuesday. We start at 7 p.m., so show up at 6:30 so you can get a good table and get yourself a nice beverage or some food to sit down with, although there is no requirement to do so. So, let's see, did I have other announcements, specific announcements to be made? Nah. Don't think so. I think that was the main one. Do I have somebody scheduled for this program next week? Let me look at my calendar. It gets confusing. I've been having to juggle a great many things of late. And, curiously, no. For the morning of the 6th, the evening of the 5th, morning of the 6th, I don't seem to have marked it down that I have anybody specific. I do know that Thursday morning the 20th, our guest will be Mimi Mondel, and that will be a lot of fun. And let us see. So, as I said, if people want to call up and discuss things science fiction, fantasy related, and so forth, 212-209-2877. And if people don't, well then, no problem. We'll just play some more music. Maybe some more Bonzo Dog Band. Only played one short thing last week in honor of the also recently deceased, in that case, both Terry Jones and Neil Innes. And it shan't be too hard to find material, or even more Kingston Trio, because I've been getting very nostalgic. and very bothered by all the people, Buck Henry, all the people that have died since the beginning of December. It just seems like there's been an extraordinarily sad concentration of the end of mortality for a good many people and TV shows. The final episode of The Good Place, hard to believe that you know. Well, they're going out on a high. Every season they continue getting better and better and better, although nothing will ever quite come up to the mind-screwing event of the last episode of season one. But still, they've been doing very well, and they're going out from every episode being half an hour to tomorrow night's, or by now, at least in New York here, tonight's episode of The Good Place. So we'll see what they will do with that. Magicians, I'm pleased to say, has been keeping up its fabulous level. And as I said earlier in the show, Doctor Who began its season very poorly. And then in episode four, did at least two really wonderful, fine things, and all of a sudden the show seems to be back on track, which frankly it was not until now. So, okay, no phone calls coming in, or at least no lights lighting up, because sometimes I find out later that it's been a technology issue. So, let's see. Yeah, let me try some. I know. Since we had a show not long ago about the Beatles, Neil Innes had a certain hand in the best parody that the Beatles ever had, the Ruddles, which also involved Eric Idle and some of the members of the Bonzo Dog Band. So, let's hear at least one song from the Ruddles, shall we?
Always thought in the back of my mind, she There's a farm called Misery, but of that we'll have none, because we know of one that's always lots of fun. And this one's name is Jollity. Believe me, folks, it's great, for everything sings out to us as we go through the gate. All the little pigs, they grunt and howl, the cats meow, the dogs bow wow, everybody makes a row down on Jollity Farm. All the little pigs, they grunt and howl,
grunt, howl, grunt, howl,
the cats meow,
meow, meow,
the dogs bow wow,
rough, 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 rough.
Everybody makes a row down on Jollity Farm. All the little birds go tweet, tweet, tweet. The lambs all bleat and shake their feet. Everything's a perfect treat down on Jollity Farm. Regular as habit, the cocks begin to crow, and the old buck rabbit sings,
stuff it up a jumper,
vododio. All the little ducks go quack, quack, quack. The cows all moo, the bull does too. Everyone says, how do you do down on Jollity Farm?
About a man named Charlie on that tragic and fateful day. He put 10 cents in his pocket, kissed his wife and family, went to ride on the MTA.
But did he ever return? No, they never returned.
And his fate is still unlearned.
He may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's a man who never returned.
Charlie handed in his dime at the Kendall Square station, and he changed for to make a plane. When he got there, the conductor told him one more nickel, Charlie couldn't get off of that train.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned. And his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever in the streets of Boston. He's a man who never returned.
Now all night long, Charlie rides through the station crying, what will become of me? How can I afford to see my sister in Chelsea or my cousin in Roxbury?
But did he ever return? Oh, he never returned. And his fate is still unclear. He may ride forever through the streets of Boston. He's a man who never returned.
Charlie's wife goes down to the Scully Square station every day at 2:15. And through the open window she adds, Charlie is sandwiched as the train goes rumbling through.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned. And his fate is still unclear.
He may ride
forever in the streets of Boston. He might never return.
Now, you citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay and pay? Fight the fare increase, vote for George O'Brien, get for Charlie off that MTA.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned. And his fate is still unclear. He may ride forever in the streets of Boston. He's a man who never returned. He's a man who never returned.
tonight she's in her grave at the bottom of the sea.
Oh, tell me what were the names, tell me what were the names. Do you have a friend of Gerilim and James? Oh, tell me what were the names, tell me what were the names. Did you have a friend of Gerilim and James?
100 men went down to their dark and watery graves when that good ship went down. 44 was saved. Was the last day of October. They saved 44 from the dark, icy waters of that cold Iceland shore.
Oh, tell me what were the names? Tell me what were the names? Did you have a friend of the good Reuben James?
Oh, tell me what were the names? Tell me what were the names? Did you have a friend of the good Reuben James?
It was there in the dark of that cold and watery night, they watched for the U-boat and they waited for a fight.
Then a whine and a rock and the great explosion's roar,
they laid the Reuben James on the cold ocean floor.
Oh, tell me what were the names, tell me what were the names. Did you have a friend of the good Reuben James?
Tell me what were the names, tell me what were.
And the best of men must die.
Oh, tell me what were the names, tell me what were the names. Did you have a friend of the good Reuben James?
Tell me what were the names,
tell me what were the names. Did you have a friend of the good Reuben James?
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week from 1 to 3 a.m. in New York City, and I hope that you will join us. Stay tuned now for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, coming your way over these same airwaves. Everybody, be good to each other, and have a good week.
said that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torture the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system works. Jerk, my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag to... So what?
Pittsburgh. Yeah. Gotta be a Thursday. Kyle Anthony says it's gotta be a Thursday. This gotta be on the radio, right? Hey, burn, baby, burn, clappers. Burn, baby, burn, 5 minutes. Cinco minutos. Cinco minutos. Cinco minutos after 3 o'clock, flag burning time right here, 99 Cinco Lista live on the radio with brand new music, first time on the air, first time on the air on WBAI, first time on the air, not anywhere but right here, WBAI, brand new. Vinnie Price, that tune for you, hear them new tune, yeah.
Girl, I don't know what's come over me. I've made my plan and you're in it, girl. Yeah, now let's go make us some memories. Cause everything you do inspires. You are what my life requires. And I'm never letting you slip away. You're such a queen in all your majesty, with amazing style and grace, and a smile upon your face. You're such a queen, and I will, if you let me, be the king that you deserve. Your heart I will preserve. There's no place else that I.
Cause I mean it well.
Sound Mortimer, right here at 99.5, 99.5. Listen live right here, wishing you a happy, happy 220 Scotch. Happy New Year, you know? So we do it, so we do it. I told you Jamaica was gonna get a earthquake, but you didn't believe me, right? Jamaica was gonna get an earthquake. I told you that, but you didn't believe me. Celebrating the year of the rat right here, 99 Cinco Lista Live on the radio. Señor, por favor, todos los días. En el imperialístico de América. Por favor.
Que no puede vacilar.
El Baba Bacon Revoluciones.
Si donde quiera que
todos
se
los días. Muy posible in these times. The year of the rat. Hear them, Junior. Bad.
De noche brinca la verja que está detrás de mi casa. A ver si puede fugarse sin que ya lo pueda ver. Y no tan pronto, no tan pronto está de fiesta. Silvestre felino tiene que echar a correr.
Felipe Luciano.
Esto sí es serio, mi amigo.
Esto es para ti.
Oye, qué lío se va a formar.
Él está muy malo.
Cuando mi gatito sepa. Y es tan simple la razón.